Our senior editor, Praveen Swami, wrote an article titled How England's Dying Industrial Towns Became the West's Largest Jihad Factory. I am Sukriti Watts and I bring you the podcast version of this article. Fire washed over Khans one summer night in 1992, unleashed by the swelling mob of young people who had swept up Baklava Street in England's Blackburn town to lay siege to the cafe. The exact story of that riot, like that of most riots, is opaque. In some tellings, it erupted because of a post-cricket match brawl in which ethnic Punjabi Muslims beat up an ethnic Gujarati Muslim. Others allude to forbidden love between a Gujarati girl and a Punjabi boy. Still others that it had something to do with gangs. As investigators in two continents now work to piece together, what led 44-year-old Malik Faisal Akram to travel across the Atlantic to take hostages at synagogue in Texas, US. The story of the riot in his hometown helps understand how England's dying industrial towns turned into the West's largest jihad factory. 1,400 United Kingdom citizens, almost all second and third generation immigrants, are estimated to have served with the Islamic State alone. Quote, British fighters have been found on almost every jihadist battlefield since Afghanistan in the 1970s, scholar Raffaello Pantucci has recorded. The year after the Blackburn riot, a then unfamiliar preacher from Pakistan arrived at the town's Jama Masjid, the center of its mainly Punjabi-Pakistani community, on a winding tour which led him through London's East End and Lancashire's mouldering industrial towns. The exact circumstances under which the Jaish-e-Mohammed chief, Masood Azhar Alvi, was granted a visa was unclear. It's improbable that the British intelligence in Islamabad had heard nothing of him. In any case, Azhar left no one in doubt about his intentions. Quote, the youth should prepare for jihad without any delay. Unquote. One tape of his speeches from that tour records. Quote, they should get jihadist training from whatever they can. We are also ready to suffer our services. The story of Masood Azhar's trip to Britain does not fit the narrative promoted by Muslim community leaders and security experts alike, unquote, a British Broadcasting Corporation documentary noted. Quote, according to them, the spread of jihadist ideology in Britain had nothing to do with UK's mainly South Asian mosques. The source of all the trouble, they say, was a bunch of Arab Islamist exiles, unquote. From the end of the Afghan Jihad in 1979, large numbers of Arab jihadists had indeed made London their home, under the benign gaze of its intelligence services. The view among British intelligence may have been, given the Cold War context, that having these jihadists in London gave the United Kingdom useful leverage in West Asia and Pakistan. Even more important, likely, was the idea that mosque leadership and political Islam would help control an increasingly alienated second-generation immigrant cohort. French intelligence officials wary of arguing with the British counterparts on the dangers growing up across the English Channel coined a wry nickname for the city on the Thames, Londonistan. There was, however, method in the apparent madness. In the late 1970s, the time Akram's generation was growing up, race riots exploded across England, centered around unemployed youth. In the industrial cities where Pakistani immigrants had arrived as mill workers in the 1950s, the riots first Indian Muslims and Pakistani Muslims fighting each other, then whites fighting both, and all joining together to fight the police, sparked fears that the surging white nationalist movement and immigrant rage could spark off a race war. British authorities responded by seeking to engage immigrant leadership. In the case of Bangladeshi and Pakistani immigrants, successive governments reach out to so-called community leaders, often clerks in mosques and individuals linked to extremist Muslim groups like the Jamaat-e-Islami. Quote, government engaged primarily with extremists, unquote, scholar Michael Vine has noted. Quote, this was a consequence of its failure to understand Islamist strategies. The mosques and imams, National Advisory Board and the roadshow are still dominated by Islamists, unquote. In the 1990s, a new generation of radicals emerging from the mosque rebelled against these brokers by arguing there could be no justice in a secular democratic order. The new Islamist cells often represented themselves as a virtuous yet masculine counterpoise to gang culture. Indeed, some parents supported their children participating, hoping it would keep them off the streets. Kenan Malik, a British scholar, noted in a 2011 essay that young British Muslims found themselves detached from both the religious tradition of their parents, which they often reject, and the wider secular society that insists on viewing them as simply Muslims. A few are drawn inevitably to extremist Islamist groups where they discover a sense of identity and of belonging. From his pulpit at the Four Feathers Club, Umar Mahmood preached to Richard Ride, the shoe bomber who attempted to blow up a transatlantic flight in 2003, and 9/11 conspirator Zakaria Mosai. Bosnian Jihad veteran Mustafa Kamal, a Brighton-trained civil engineer and one-time nightclub bouncer, sent volunteers to Yemen. The bombing of the Indian Army's headquarters in Srinagar in December 2000, the 2010 plot to mark the anniversary of 9/11, these involved elements linked to London-based Omar Bakri Muhammad. England seemed to bring about an almost magical ideological metamorphosis. London School of Economics students Ahmed Omar Said Sheikh became a Jaish-e-Muhammad killer. Dhiren Barot, son of an affluent Gujarati Hindu family, into a Kashmiri jihadist Al-Qaeda bomb plot operative. Siddhartha Dhar into the Islamic State's murderous jihad Sid. Attacks like London bombings of 7/7, which claimed 56 lives, have been preempted due to better policing and intelligence. There is, however, a steady flow of individual jihadists like Akram. Roshanara Chaudhry stabbed British Member of Parliament Stephen Timms. Michael Adebolajo, who hacked to death a British soldier on the streets of southeast London. Like them, Akram had no unknown affiliation with jihadist groups, either online or physically. He was religious, serving at a local mosque and volunteering, like millions of others, with the Pietist Tablighi Jamaat. But his activities never attracted the attention of the United Kingdom's intelligence services. The ideas that led him to take four people hostage in Texas seem to have seeped into his mind almost as it were by osmosis. Ever since 7/7 London bombings, the United Kingdom has sought to address its jihad problem, cracking down on terrorism suspects and in parallel spending millions marketing purportedly moderate anti-jihadist forms of Islam. The gains from the project are, however, unclear. In a 2006 survey, 6 of every 100 British Muslims were reported to support the 7/7 bombings. The following year, 25% said the terrorist attack was a government plot. Worse, British cities remain profoundly ghettoized. In a 2016 government report, Louise Casey revealed that the people of Pakistani and Bangladeshi ethnicity tend to live in more residentially segregated communities than other ethnic minority groups. 50% of school-age children from these communities, she found, studied in an institution where the majority of students were from the same ethnic groups. This is the question of our time, author Salman Rushdie asked. Quote, how does a fractured community of multiple cultures decide what values it must share in order to cohere? Unquote. Akram's story is, in the final analysis, a parade of what happens when communities come to define themselves by their differences and identify congeals into hatred. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode.